In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to episode 33 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. We do have an apology this week of Nigel, who has a loss in the family. So our condolences to Nigel and his family. But we have, for the rest, a full show. We have Gabriel, Mark, and Rickatron with me.
Yay!
Hey!
Hey, it's Thursday!
Yeah.
Or wait, no, it's Wednesday.
For me, it is Thursday. Hey, I want to start off with good news, actually. Gabriel, you made yet another career move.
Yeah, what else is new? Yes, thank you. I am. I've moved on from Cisco. I am now a cloud architect focusing on agile infrastructure with SolidFire.
Hey, now, you're actually joining one hell of a crew there.
As we've heard on this show, as we've discussed...
No, the funny thing was, is like when I was looking to move from SimpliVity, I talked to SolidFire back then, and it wasn't a good fit in terms of the role. And, but always in the back of my mind, it was, there's a crew of people there that I'm desperate to work with, some very, very sharp minds, who are building something that is truly unique in my point of view. And I cannot wait to go there. And it just turned out to be that, the position that was best for me is the one that was kind of came open and not necessarily created, but came open. And so, you know, it's a win-win situation. I get to go work with some people I really respect and trust and like, and I get to work on some technology that I'm really excited about, especially in the space that I've tried to focus on in the last couple of years. So for me, it's like I'm really stoked. And today is actually my first official day. So,
congratulations.
Now I've got the socks on.
Well, that's why you got the new, Skype profile pic, haircut, you know, a collar this time. You're looking good, man.
Yeah. I tried.
In all transparency, when the Veeam gig was over, I started looking at all companies I would like to join, and SolidFire was number one on my list. Like you said, it's finding the right role, and they haven't found a role to hire a cross-Atlantic guy yet, so... We'll figure out maybe somewhere in the future. I mean, and that was even before any of that new Rockstar crew was on there. So SolidFire, awesome company, awesome technology, and now with the crew behind it, it's going to be rocking. Rickatron, how was your week?
Week has been good. I actually just came off of RSA conference in San Francisco. You guys were in London doing your cool thing. I was doing my work thing. That was a pretty cool event. The security... discussion.
Come on, that has to be a boring event.
No. Hey, I'm the guy that finds backup interesting, you know?
Okay,
roaming the streets and hills of San Francisco.
I enjoyed it, friends. It was, actually, it's funny because when I was last on the podcast, I was going to another security conference in the Maritimes of Canada, Atlantic Security Conference in Halifax. And so I had two security conferences back to back, and they couldn't have been more different. The first one was very kind of independent and run. The second one was very corporate and all. But I really took the best away from security. And one of them I had a presentation at, and then I'm doing the Veeam thing at the other. It was a good, you know, time and all. I just find that the security crowd is a different discussion, and I actually very much enjoyed it in regards to data availability.
Tell me something you learned last week that you had no idea or an epiphany or whatever did you take away from the RSA convention?
Well, I talked to Firemon a little bit, and I just thought they did a pretty cool way of looking at there's a lot of people that do this, but I spoke to Firemon, so that's the only one I liked. But the way that they visualized like obsolete firewall rules and stuff like that, I thought that was kind of cool and report on that, because I've been there on the other end where I'm making these rules and it's truly a mess and can't figure out what's wrong. And sometimes different networking stacks will allow one deny rule would be second priority over an allow rule. They can really help you sort that out. I thought that was pretty slick.
Oh, I remember that. And in the end, the only thing you did was all.
That's right, because all always works.
Yeah. Mark, how was your week?
It was just terrific. I have no details to offer, but I had a great week.
what beer are you having? Let's go that
today
way.
Today I'm having a Strike Irish Red. Strike is a new brewery in San Jose, and they brew at the Hermitage Brewery on South 7th Street, which has opened up a very nice little tasting room. They've got the big stainless steel conical cylinders in there. They brew their own brews, lots of really good ones. One of the things that Hermitage does that I really like is they have the same wort going, and then they come out with different variations using different hops. So if you want to find out what different hops taste like, if you stick with the program with them, you can taste the same beer made with different hops. Anyway, that's not what Strike's about. Strike's a little company. They've done contract brewing with Hermitage, and that's what I'm having today. Nice beer. It's a nice, got a very nice red color. They use some crystallized malt in there. It's a malt frontal forward beer, and I'm digging it.
What do you mean with contract brewing? Is that like making a brew specific for one specific customer?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of that goes on here, Hans, mm-hmm. where a brewery has excess capacity, and they make it available so somebody else can bring a recipe in. You know, say if my buddy Tony and I decided we had a recipe for something like a black IPA or something, if we wanted to make a lot of it, we could go there and pay for all the ingredients, and they would brew it for us, and it would be sanitary, and it wouldn't have bacteria in it and all that stuff.
Okay, but it would be customized to your recipe.
Yes.
Which is
something
different than what we have, for example, in Belgium, is it's more from a marketing perspective. If we have label beers, and it means that they brew a whole batch, but they distribute it in smaller batches, the same beer under a different label. If you want to buy a beer for your company, for a marketing activity, that's called label beers. But that's different from what you're saying, which is brewing according to your customized recipe, right?
Right. So, for instance, the Gordon Biersch Brewery here is a pretty good-sized brewery in San Jose, and they've got a label, and they make really nice lagers. But they also make beers for several of different companies in the area, and some of them are breweries, some of them are grocery stores. They make the private label beer for Trader Joe's, and they produce some of the beers for Prohibition, which is one of my favorite breweries in San Francisco. I was surprised to find that out in a tour of Gordon Biersch, because they like to keep this stuff kind of secret, or they don't want it to be, widely known. But yeah, different breweries will make different beers for different companies to their recipes here, Hans. I think it's a pretty common practice.
Okay.
It is in the States. The one big difference, Hans, and a Belgian guy will appreciate this, is you can't fake out the water. My beloved Hoegaarden, right? There's bloody revolt when they moved to the other river. They can't do that in the States. Nope. The little giveaway here in the States when you can sniff out contract brew is you can look closely, especially at bottles, the bottle technology, everything from the capping to the very specific shape of the bottle, or if you buy a brewery that you like and then all of a sudden it's in a can, but it's not usually in a can, those are some of the dead giveaways. One of my favorites, Frankenmuth Brewery in Michigan, does that stuff, but it's passing my sniff test, so I like contract brews.
Awesome.
Frankenmuth.
Yeah, baby.
That sounds like beer and vermouth.
Better than that. Frankenmuth's a wonderful little German Bavarian town in mid-Michigan.
Cool. Awesome.
Very cool.
Hey, guys, let's bring it back a little bit to the show of last week. So we were in London. We had a great week. I can't tell you how great it was. We've had the feedback coming in from the event with Enrico, Tech Unplugged, which was all very great feedback. And he's already planning on a second event in September, I think, in Amsterdam, which is close enough for me, so I'm probably going to be there as well. What did you guys think about the recording of last week? And I think more specifically, let's dig into the VMware container news with the release of Photon, Lightwave, the Lattice stuff, and the interview with Joe Bagley. Who wants to start with that?
Oh, man, you guys knocked it out of the park. It's a great show. It's terrific. And Joe was fantastic at the end. That little snippet with Joe, I know we don't do a lot with vendors, but Joe was dynamite. I thought it was terrific.
Now, all my interactions with Joe over the years have been great. And, he's a very engaging speaker, and I thought that was a nice end cap to, and came to the show, especially given all of the buzz and all the great stuff that you guys did over in London that week.
Yeah, I agree. It was a cracking way to kind of put an external resource on, and I got nothing but good to say about Joe. In fact, Joe freaked me out because usually I don't know those big kind of profile people bi-directionally, but Joe knew me before I knew him, and that was kind of creepy. But I love me some Joe Bagley. But I think the real takeaway on this containerization strategy is just what I've been saying all along. If it's important, if you're going to be running cloud-native apps and doing stuff like containers, and if it's an important app and you need to make it available, you're going to want to run it on an infrastructure like vSphere, period. I'm all in.
I think the big thing takeaway here is that it's not just an announcement of yeah we'll support Docker, right? It is really strategy wise going open source with new projects. I mean the mini Linux that they're making themselves, the Lightwave LDAP stuff. It's more than we expected. Is that a fair thing to say?
No, and I definitely think that their announcement took a lot of people by, you know, kind of off guard, right? I mean, they weren't expecting, you know, everybody thought, oh, yeah, well, VMware is going to do something around, you know, containerization and DevOps and these things. But to come out with an entire suite of products that focus specifically on that arena is something that I think that, you know, most people didn't even think was going to happen, right? I mean, other than people who are in the know or, you know, maybe some analysts or a few people that they've talked to in the past, most people probably got caught kind of flat-footed that VMware was going to come out with such a comprehensive suite.
I mean, 2 weeks before that, we had the whole LinkedIn discussion of VMware is a legacy platform.
And I don't agree with that, but that's another discussion.
No, I didn't agree either, but we had a very big discussion around that, and no one saw this coming in that short amount of time. I mean, like 1 or 2 weeks later.
Let's not get over our ski tips here, right? The thing is, traditionally, 80 to 90% of VMware's run rate business is going to be legacy application infrastructure support, right? That they're moving into open systems, that they're moving into data center operating systems, if they're moving into containerization, is like it's an attempt to stay relevant. It's an attempt to say, hey, you know, we are still working, we are still evolving as an organization, but let's not, you know, it's a first effort. It's going to be interesting to see how customers adopt and want to move forward with it, especially after you know, the competition in that space is high. Right, you have several defined players who have a preponderance or a much larger market share in that particular workload solution. So it's an uphill battle that VMware is kind of facing. But I applaud them for actually making the leap to move forward into it, even though it's on kind of their own terms. And the same thing happens with, you know, I would say the same thing about VMware Integrated OpenStack, as well as several other efforts that they've made to move into a new computing space that where they don't necessarily play all the time.
Okay, great. Let's see what we have on this week's tech news. Right, I have 3 points on the agenda of which two of them will take the majority of our time. First of all, Hitachi announces a hyperscale out platform. Secondly, we have Infinidat coming out of stealth with and it's not only the company stuff, but there's a little bit product information behind it. And lastly, a very small one, Microsoft releasing Visual Studio Lite for Linux and Mac OS X. Let's go into the biggest one of the three here. Hitachi announces a hyperscale out platform, which is a 20 nodes in a rack system, 192 gigs of RAM, lots of terabytes of 3.5-inch disks and 2.5-inch disks with a back end and a front end, 40 gig, 10 gig. So it's a node-based system, comes out not with a Hadoop distribution, but it will have an Hitachi file system. They're not naming it, but it would be object-based in the back end with a file front end. And it would support HDFS, or Hadoop distributed file system API. The file front end would be a POSIX compliant file system interface.
What's it do? What are people supposed to do with it?
It looks like it's focused today on Hadoop type distributions and solutions, but it would be a flexible thing where you could do different. it's a scale out system with a file system underneath it, a kind of a hyper-converged solution without having it to run specifically on the hypervisor. So it is compute and storage within itself, but it doesn't really say this is the only thing you can do with it. So it could be like Linux bare metal with local storage with the distributed file system. It could be that it comes with KVM already underneath it. It doesn't say anything about other hypervisors. But so it is node-based architecture instead of host switches and storage underneath it.
So it sounds like a box that's mostly hardware without that much enabling software to be a solution.
I think they're going after a very specific market with this particular platform, and it's kind of a rack scale distributed, a solution. You know, obviously it's going to be something that's attractive to the people that are going to want to, provision a large scale Hadoop infrastructure at the rack level instead of the node level. Right. And I've seen that with specific customers with, 5, 7, 1,000 node Hadoop clusters. They're looking for something simple, easily scalable, and easily turnkeyed at that particular order of magnitude or that particular orderable scale. Right.
So they do that. So it's supposed to do that, but it doesn't come with Hadoop.
You can get it with a Hadoop distribution, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that. So I think the key parts here are the Hitachi file system, which I think is new, and secondly that it would also have a node-based management, which is one of the key ingredients for me in a type of hyperconverged solution where it's going to be scaling per node, but also in a management layer, adding a node, retiring nodes, that type of management.
They're also putting the Penaho stuff, which hopefully I sent that right. The Penaho announcement they made earlier this year, there's KVM is going to be the hypervisor of choice that they're going to provision with. It's a means to an end. I mean, we're talking, it supposedly supports 48 petabytes of shared space. So that's not small by any stretch of the imagination. And there's certain customers out there that this is going to be very attractive to. Hitachi has always been one of those organizations that I think has made very, very good, solid solutions, but has always struggled to market them and, translate the value proposition to the end user.
What's the Pentaho for? Is that workflow technology or what is that?
Yeah, honestly, I forgot.
Okay, yeah. So it is related to analytics in one way or another, but I think it's a workflow tool, right? I mean, so a customer can go out and they can buy a rack of this kind of technology from Teradata, which is already set up to do big data analytics work, or they can buy two different systems from Cray that do this. They've got one that does graphical analysis and another one with Hadoop, and So Hitachi's coming out with something now that is sort of...
Like their version of Greenplum, right? Or to a certain extent, or HP's Vertica. It's an appliance-based or a modular rack scale-based appliance that would leverage those kind of business analytics.
Right, so where's the professional services or where's the services going to come from that's really going to help make this thing take off and useful for customers? Yeah. So does Hitachi going to do that, though, is the question.
No, I doubt it.
Right. See, this is the point I'm getting to. Right. I know it sounds like an interesting thing, but I think this is lost. I think this is Hitachi sort of like cutting off their thumb and throwing it out there and saying, okay, here's your thing. Come and get it, guys. If we build it, they will come. It's not that easy.
I agree with you, Mark. It's a mess to sort through, but you got to look at what they're doing. I think they're bundling storage and compute, which they've made them both for a long time. Their compute, UCP, Unified Compute Platform. I mean, it's very big in Japan, much like myself. But anyways.
I love that line. It always makes me think of Tom Waits.
So, but basically they're putting together a lot of good technology, as Gabe said. I hate to say it. They need a name here. Hans, your description was good and complete, but it tells nobody what it does, to Mark's point. No. So I think they need a name like Hitachi Pod or something, or Hitachi BI. They need something.
Yeah, it's now Hitachi's hyper scale out platform.
still tells me nothing.
Yeah, I know. So the whole deal is all the converged stuff that Hitachi has done till now has always been the classic server switches storage. And this is the first time that I've seen them coming with a node-based architecture that would also be managed that way. And apparently with a distributed file system of which I haven't heard because they're not disclosing it.
I'd call it bento box. Get you a little bit of piece of here and there, you know, a little bit of sushi, a little bit of sashimi.
I like pickled ginger myself.
It puts all the little bits and pieces that you need for business analytics in a big box that you can leverage.
So I was reading the article on it, they talked about overcoming some shortcoming that you have in being able to scale across nodes in a Hadoop file system.
So the name nodes are the metadata servers, and if you distribute that, you don't have a bottleneck in your metadata access.
Oh yeah, sure. If you have one metadata server, that would be a bottleneck. So interesting. Okay, so they've got probably a cluster approach to doing that. That makes sense. Thanks.
Okay. So moving on to a long waiting out of stealth Infinidat, and to give it a little bit of background, Infinidat is the new project of Moshe Yanai, who previously came from, it's actually the lead developer of EMC Symmetrix in the 90s, and then started Diligent and XIV, which he sold to IBM, and now has this Infinidat thing, which is a hyperscale storage, again, another hyper one, 2 petabyte in a rack, up to 750K IOPS in that rack as such, and built on top of Dell PowerEdge servers. I haven't followed this closely myself, and I'm not really seeing the biggest value here. I think I'm missing something. 750,000 IOPS is not that impressive for me in Iraq. I'm not sure 2 petabyte in Iraq is that impressive. I think that's what they're going for the volume. Help me out here.
Cost? Are they winning on price? Price per IOP? Yeah, price per IOP per square floor tile. I mean, there are people out there that on certain scales, I mean, they look at it that way, and their metrics, their business metrics, and if they're going to come in with the lowest number of cost per IOP, then maybe there's a market for that.
Well, I mean, also in terms of the functionality that they're providing that box, it's kind of like everything to everyone. You know, it's got like, you know, NFS, it's got all of the different storage connectivity aspects of it. It's kind of like XIV 2.0 on steroids. It's got 1.48 terabytes of cache plus another 48 terabytes of auxiliary second tier. I mean, it's going to be the kind of box that, you know, it's maybe it's a second bite of the apple and re-architecting XIV to scale out at a level that's much higher. But also, if you look at the price point about what they're doing, it's 480 disks, 480 spinning spindles at, you know, in what, 2 petabytes at 200K, I think is the entry point. And, you know, and also it's, you know, it's going to have some open storage technologies in there as well, or object storage technologies in there. So it's kind of like doing a lot of different things and making it simple. You know, object storage technology, object storage provisioning and implementation is definitely not something that's overtly simple or easy to integrate with. If they can take the same look and feel and simplicity that they brought to market with XIV, which was a very, very simple solution to drive, and bring that to the enterprise, I think they will do well and sell well. You know, I've talked to the Infinidat guys a couple times at different trade shows over the last year or two. So, I mean, for them to say that it's coming out of stealth, it may be more of like they're just coming out to market or start to market themselves much more aggressively than they were in the past.
They've been selling since 2013 to specific customers. So the product has been in the hand of customers for 2 to 3 years now, which is a long time to be in stealth, by the way.
Right. I mean, and, you know, in reality is Moshe, anything he's done in the past has done well. You know, he's got a great reputation, you know, as kind of one of the godfathers of storage. I mean, in fact, you know, when I worked at Toshiba back in 2009, Moshe actually came out and did the full XIV pitch to us. And for me being back then when I was, you know, I was a nobody, still am, but you know, back then to have Moshe come in and actually sit in my conference room and pitch me his product was like, you know, I was a little starstruck. And, you know, it's he definitely, I mean, they filed 90 patents already, mm-hmm. you know, and there's a lot of intellectual property there. It's probably an acquisition target for somebody if they get them cheap. But they've taken a lot of money, too. You know, they're another one of those groups that's on the $250 million in funding range.
Yeah.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right? They've taken a ridiculous amount of money. So let's look at what Moshe did in the past. I mean, at EMC, you know, Cimetrix became the thing inside EMC, and it became, highly polarized, if you will, inside the company, because he was just trying to drive that like crazy. And he was very successful there. And EMC, as a result, was very successful. Don't get me wrong. I'm not taking away anything from what happened at EMC, but he had an enormous sales force out there to sell that product, and the company needed that product, and it was very successful. So when he developed XIV, he was selling through IBM, and it was a similar situation where IBM really needed that product. They were dead in the water, you know, for the most part with their own, you know, enterprise arrays, and XIV was the answer for them, and they had people out there that were very hungry for product to sell. I say that, and I know that the sales enablement side of that must have been just horrendous for XIV, you know, to get past. They had to try to bring a lot of IBM salespeople that really didn't care that much about storage or know that much about storage necessarily and turn them on to make it work. But it was a really great deal because IBM really needed a solution and Moshe brought it. Who and how are they going to sell this product?
Yeah. So that's my whole thing here. I mean, huge respect for the accomplishments of history, specifically from Moshe himself. It's the NEA group that is backing this with the 230 mil in total for a big part. I get it. There's the right people, the right money is there. I just don't see it from that first press release. I'm totally not. Maybe I'm missing the epiphany here or reading something not, but other than a lot of volume on a small footprint, I don't really see a big new thing coming on here.
Well, I don't see analytics built in, you know, I don't see them, and maybe analytics is something they can add later. Maybe it's not. Maybe that's not going to be a thing in the market. I do know that they've hired some really good salespeople that I've worked with, people that worked at 3PAR, that I worked with at StorSimple. You might think, well, StorSimple, small box. These were really good salespeople, though, and they've gone to work for them, Infinidat. So he is hiring some very good salespeople. I know that. So he's getting skills. He's getting people that he's used to working with. But there's still a small number. I mean, for the types of numbers that he's talking about where they've taken in funding and where the size of the company that expects this to be, you've got to really blow the doors out. And if he's going to try to do it himself this time, I just don't think he's got enough firepower.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, $230 million with a funding valuation of $1.3 billion just coming out of stealth, those are big numbers.
My guess is he is going to try to sell it, though, to somebody that really needs it. And the question is, who needs it, right? And it's getting to be a smaller, consolidation in the industry. It's fewer and fewer people that can afford to do it and can do it. I mean, is your old company, Cisco, going to buy this? I mean, who's going to go for this?
It's a curveball here. What, you know, reading what I can on the website without signing up to get the full story. And one thing I like is that it's very up stack aware, and it talks a lot about some application awareness, operating system awareness. Those types of things are interesting. I also, SQL and Exchange, SharePoint awareness, that's kind of cool, right? So maybe there's not so much analytics, but awareness, kind of a different angle. I did also see here that they're going to be at VMworld and three of the VMware user group, UserCon events on the East Coast in May and June. Might be worth going and figuring it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it doesn't have flash at this point, right? It's all spinning REST?
It's got cache and flash.
Yeah.
Oh, it does?
Yeah, so there's 86 terabyte of flash cache across the three nodes is what it says here.
86 terabytes out of a max. I assume that's a maximum number, or is that a set number?
480 hard disks together with 86 terabyte of flash cache.
Yeah, no, it's also got an architecture that looks like it's similar to XIV insofar that when he talks about scalability, it's, you know, basically it's in one system in one rack. Yeah. These things, this is not scale out in any way. The quote that was interesting from the article in the Register was that it scales by using larger disk drives, right? And they kind of explain it. I'm serious, right? So, I mean, if you buy one of these things, you better make sure you buy the large size of, you know, which was a flaw for XIV. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can say what you want. You know, if a cabinet is big enough, you might say, do I really need to scale beyond a couple petabytes? And the answer is, well, how many customers actually need to scale beyond that? And it's not that many. But we're in this age, you know, of 30-40%, you know, year-on-year data growth. And we're getting there. You know, data is getting bigger and bigger all the time. So it will be interesting to see if scalability is an issue for him this time around. It really wasn't that big a problem for XIV.
Yeah, you've hit one thing on the head there. This is not a scale-out solution. Like I said, the 480 disks are behind three servers, right? And those three servers have 3.2 terabytes of RAM and 86 terabytes of flash cache. So it definitely is a servers plus back-end disks type of solution.
Yeah, and that sounds a lot like the XIV architecture, mm-hmm. which you know, was successful and worked, and companies are using it. I'm not being critical there. It's just saying that sounds like a do-over there.
Yeah.
With I'm sure some enhancements and the patents that they've stacked up, there must be some that apply to that.
Okay.
It's got to be up from the drives. That's my guess. It's the only way to go.
Yeah. I just don't see how much this, for now, as I see it, is doing something that someone else would not be able to do with other existing platforms. But hey, that's just me, right?
Right. No, you would think that both EMC and HP, for instance, could develop products or may already have products that can compete with it.
Yeah. So one of the things that you saw in the TechTarget article is that apparently they are replacing 3PAR systems that do not scale beyond 1 petabyte per rack with a solution that now scales to 2 petabytes per rack, which is, from a footprint perspective, if you do 2-to-1 in a data center, it could make sense. But
it certainly could.
So in larger environments, I do see that, but I don't see that in smaller solution. It would definitely have to like scale per rack to get this out of it.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch. He's always had the guy's always had an angle. He's always got focus, and you know, like I said, I know he's hiring some awfully good people to work for him. So you know, he's not messing around.
Okay, let's follow up on that and see what happens in the near or long-term future. Last point, it's really a small point. Microsoft releases Visual Studio Lite for Linux and macOS X, and the only thing that I actually wanted to say about that is that be aware of the fine print, because it says crash dumps will be sent to Microsoft. If you don't like it, don't install it.
Whoa.
But, I mean, it's something we haven't seen before from Microsoft yet again, bringing their Visual Studio and so on to Linux and Mac OS X. It does kind of make sense in that new era. I just like that small fine print line there. You know what? We'll try to make some software for Mac OS X, so we'll grab your crash dumps, whether you like it or not.
Well, spin it the other way out of build today. Their announcement for the Windows Phone was that app developers for iOS and Android can run them through a toolkit to make them work on Windows Phone. I think that's a really good broad ecosystem play. I'm excited for that in the Visual Studio for Linux. That would be kind of cool. Because honestly, I'd love to get a Windows Phone, but I can't use the apps I need. I love my Surface, even though they're going to kill RT.
You don't want a Windows Phone. Come on, we did a whole series on Windows Phone apps.
It's time to do another secret Windows Phone app.
Yeah, I think so, Mark.
It might be around Visual something.
Oh, by the way, guys, I'm doing a little journey thing next week or month or something. I'm going to go 30 days without a data plan. That's going to be kind of fun.
What?
Yeah. Rickatron's going to try something.
How are you going to do that?
I am. Yeah, thank you. Congratulations to me. That's right. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go phone and text, no data plan for 30 months. Really, the way I think about it.
30 days.
Yeah, I'm switching carriers, but I'm going to go burner. I'm going to go pay as you go. I'm still going to have my smartphone, but I'm only going to use it on Wi-Fi. I'm going to do a little experiment. I'm very curious to the socio-eco, the my persona change. First of all, I won't fiddle with the darn thing when I'm driving. Second of all, I actually think I might pay attention more. I just feel like I'm so distracted with everything. It's a little experiment I'm going to try.
Right. Do you got special pills to keep purple you calm?
Pills. Yes, purple.
Hey, I want to go back to this Visual Studio thing, actually, of all things, right? I mean, why is Microsoft doing this? They're doing it because developers of Visual Studio are probably leaving or threatening to leave, or they're seeing the big opportunity, you know, developing apps for Linux and iOS. And Microsoft is trying to provide an ecosystem for their developers, their Microsoft-friendly developers, to be able to have apps on these other platforms, right? That's what that's about. And, you know, Satya Nadella is a lot smarter about this stuff than Steve Ballmer ever was. And to him, you know, it's not about the platform. It's about getting apps. It's about getting developers that are writing for you and your software, regardless of where it is. It doesn't have to be on a Surface. It doesn't have to be on Windows Server. You know, it doesn't have to be on Windows. It can be anywhere, right? So it's a very nice move. And it's consistent with other things they've done with some of their cloud technology, opening it up to OpenStack and opening it up to containers, or, you know, they're in the process of doing that. But, you know, it just signals part of the change in Microsoft. It's about the apps. It's about the developers, even though Ballmer liked to jump up and down and say it was about developers. Satya Nadella is actually doing more about it than just stupefying.
Yeah. And a final quote here that I get from the article, and this might be for the people that are looking at it, this is an interesting one as well. In addition to code editing, the new tool offers support for debugging and integrates with the Git source code management software, which is kind of like the primary way of working for new developers.
Interesting. Yeah, I think Microsoft in many ways gets it. They just have to get out of their own way, and this is part of them getting out of their own way. Okay. Whether or not they can make money doing it, how the business model changes is another thing. You know, they're not printing money with this, you know, on other platforms, but they have to do it. Okay. Hats off to Microsoft for doing it.
Yet again, how many times have we done that in the last half a year? It is so weird. We've done a couple of weird hats off.
Yeah.
Hey, there wasn't that much of tech news. We pretty much covered it this week, but it was a really big one. Earlier last week, we actually hinted at it in the recording itself, that Amazon would announce their earnings somehow of AWS. And they did. The end result, and I think that's the key we want to take away from everything there, is that Amazon in itself is as big as the four others together, or bigger, which is Google, IBM, Microsoft, and Salesforce. And that is... that's really, really big. I mean, what were you talking about? 1.6, 1.7 billion?
Yeah, it was about 40 to 50% margin on a $6 billion annual run rate, which is, I think, you know, very, very few people picked up on that level. Everybody kind of think, a lot of people lowballed it. The only person I know of, Randy Bias, back in 2011, he wrote a blog post about it. Saying that he guessed that's about what they would be at, and he was pretty prescient. So, you know, there's people out there that really understand this market and this ecosystem, and, you know, they put their money where their mouth is, or at least they put their thoughts out there for everybody to listen to, and it's interesting.
When I said $1.5 billion, that is the earnings of Q1 2015, right? So it is in a total of a run rate of $6 billion this year. $6 billion run rate, which is 50%. So the Q1 of 2015 was $1.5 billion, which was 50% more than the $1 billion they did last year in Q1. I mean, those are pretty decent numbers for running a public cloud, of which everyone thought it were running it without any profit one knowing how big it was.
They surprised a lot of people, including myself. You guys follow Bernard Golden at all on Twitter or in any way? Anyway, I had a sort of an argument with Bernard Golden, sometime 6-9 months ago. You know, about he was talking about Amazon, the strength of Amazon. I said, yeah, they lose a little bit on every deal. Well, no, it doesn't look that way. He was right, and he's been right. So, you know, along with Randy, there are other people out there that have been, you know, strongly behind Amazon, and these guys are proven to be, you know, the right. Have made the right calls on this. You know, so maybe I should pay attention to Randy a little more, Bernard also.
and Simon Wardley in that same line.
Yeah. Well, I don't know Simon as well, but I'll assume that he's somebody I should probably be paying attention to when it comes to Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments we want to give on this? What does this mean for Microsoft and Google and the others like IBM?
Well, one thing Gabriel and I were talking about this offline, and one of the things that's interesting about this is the actual cost of the infrastructure. Gabriel believes, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Gabe, but that the infrastructure cost is borne by Amazon, other Amazon services, you know, the Amazon, you know, just the whole Amazon company, right, that runs on this stuff, that a lot of the cost of this infrastructure is spread out over, you know, them selling everything and doing this massive business that they have, right, which is, what, a $60 billion business or something like that, Gabriel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, you know, Amazon didn't get into this marketplace because they wanted to go into the cloud marketplace. They went into this after they realized the economies of scale and the infrastructure that they built afforded them the ability to sell off some of the excess, and then realized that, well, we can kind of take this model that we've built internally and monetize it, productize it, and sell it to the masses in terms of public cloud. And, you know, they were way ahead of the curve on that. But, you know, without Amazon, the, you know, clicks and mortar business, there is no Amazon, you know, AWS public cloud.
Yeah, so I totally get that. So it's part of the Amazon cloud is running Amazon .org, right? Or .com, should I say. Did they disclose what percentage of their infrastructure is running their own stuff and what is public and sold to external parties?
No, that's one thing I think that the numbers betray is the scope. You know, they were very tertiary, very, very high level numbers. There was not a lot of deep digging in there. And, you know, I think it'll be up for some of the financial analysts who really know how to go through those statements to go through there and pull some of that information out based on what they've made publicly available.
So I think the mistake that I've made thinking about Amazon, I think a lot of people have, is they figured that AWS is its own separate entity with its own separate, you know, infrastructure, right? But if it is melded into the existing Amazon.com stuff, then it's a whole different economic argument, right? You talk about Google printing money with ads. You talk about Microsoft printing money with licenses. Well, Amazon doesn't necessarily print money, but if they can defray the cost of AWS by spreading that cost over the rest of Amazon.com, that is a big economic advantage for them.
It definitely is, and I think, you know, with others, releasing their numbers this month as well. I mean, I put a tweet out there. I was following Barb Darrow on Twitter, and she said something about, you know, the dynamics of it, and I'm like, well, don't discount Microsoft because, you know, they kind of have the disposable income effect. Essentially, you know, when you have $50 to $60 billion sitting in your bank account, you can slowly ramp and slowly pick at that Amazon massive market share. Now, what we all, you know, guessed at was, you know, we were all trying to guess at how much revenue Amazon was actually making on this. And for those of us who guessed low, that argument holds a little more weight. Now it looks like, you know, hey, here's a very highly profitable business, much more so than the standard Amazon online retailing. You know, they have money to turn around and reinvest in their infrastructure if they need to. They have money to turn around and invest in, you know, pure sales and pure engagement. I mean, Amazon has something like 2,000 job openings right now. It's crazy how much they want to grow that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And we hear Nigel wants to get one.
So, hey, when we say that Amazon is also running their own infrastructure within those numbers, wouldn't that be the same for a Microsoft and an IBM? Microsoft is that amount of revenue. Wouldn't that also hold Microsoft platforms for themselves?
No, I believe I believe those groups are completely separate within organizations of that scale and that size. There's internal Microsoft IT that manages their IT infrastructure that has nothing to do at all with Azure or Xbox or any of those other groups.
No, but wouldn't you see those numbers in the revenue of Azure, that part of it is hired by internal IT?
Microsoft doesn't have a big commercial engine like Amazon does, and neither does IBM, right? Amazon has this enormous sales machine,
mm-hmm.
right? And IBM and Microsoft don't. And Google doesn't.
Yeah.
The only thing that steps close to it is Xbox, and that's a completely separate division. And separate, you know, they've compartmentalized to a certain extent those different lines of businesses.
Yeah, but come on, that's nowhere close to the commercial entity that Amazon.com is. The largest retail entity on the planet is Amazon.com,
mm-hmm.
and there you go.
That brings you to the, you know, the IBM cloud numbers. Now, IBM's saying that they have a $7 billion annual, you know, revenue stream coming out of their cloud services, but then when you start to dig into those numbers, it's a bunch of other stuff that doesn't, that we wouldn't necessarily count as cloud.
No.
Or public cloud, right? And so, you know, the devil tends to be in the details. And honestly, I have not looked into it at that level of depth to really comment effectively.
Yeah, everybody's fudging their cloud numbers in one way or another, including Amazon, IBM, Microsoft, and Google. You know, and maybe someday it'll, you know, we'll understand it all. But in the meantime, it's fun to try to claw our way into it.
Well, we'll just ask the analysts to sort it out for us, guys. Come on. That's what they're there for.
Yeah. I thought that was us.
Not
Gabriel, anyway.
Hey, last point on the agenda, guys. NetApp losing another key player, JKID, CTO of NetApp, after how many years? Now retiring, but actually not just leaving the company, but really retiring from the industry. So let's take it first on the person himself. Who is JKID and what is his legacy in the last couple of decades?
ONTAP.
Is it ONTAP?
Yeah, I thought it was ONTAP.
Yeah, maybe it is. I don't know.
I've never met Jay. You know, I was kind of surprised at Chris Miller putting that tweet out today. But, you know, that's another high-level defection or somebody moving out of the technical scheme from NetApp in the last couple months. You know, you're not seeing a whole lot of high-level defections at the management layer. And, you know, it still remains to be seen if the rumors around, you know, the massive RIF or reduction in force are going to bear out or not. You know, and I thought we had a lot of very good discussion in the LinkedIn group about the state of NetApp. And you had, you know, NetApp people, and you had a lot of NetApp partners, and you had customers, and you had people inject and talk about where they see the future going. What they see the state of NetApp was, you know, it was, actually one of the better discussions I got involved in. Funnily enough, I think Hans, you and I were talking about this, is like, after making our comments, you know, half a dozen people in NetApp checked out your LinkedIn profile. So,
yeah.
Yes. Well, so you asked about the legacy. I would say actually his legacy was, to a lot of people, he was the voice of NetApp, much more so than Warmenhoven or Georgians. You know, you'd see Jay had comments in all the press releases, and he was very visible, you know, as a CTO. I mean, and it makes sense because a CTO really is a mouthpiece for a company. He's not the engineering, you know, he's not the architect. He's not that guy. He's a mouthpiece for the company. So, you know, the communication that NetApp had, and in many respects, the goodwill that a lot of people had for NetApp, the belief that people had in the company, I think a lot of that was tied to Jay and just the way he communicated. He did a great job.
Wouldn't innovation strategy be something that is really tied to this person? I mean, by nature of being CTO, that would be my first thing is looking at what's the innovation cycle that the CTO has brought to the table. And if I look back then to the LinkedIn discussion, I primarily see that NetApp has struggled to get along or to follow up on innovation. Finally, with their 8.3 or whatever they are now, would be on par. But on par is still not. I mean, so
yeah. I think we tend to put too much. We tend to think too highly of CTOs. CTOs are really better at outgoing messages than what they are at incoming. And don't get me wrong; they do work on projects, and they try to figure out what requirements are and what technologies need to be there to meet them. But most of the innovation that comes out of companies comes out of engineering and architects, not CTOs. There are of course, you know, derivations and you know, there are of course CTOs that contribute heavily. But you know, if you look at a CTO like at at EMC, for instance. Probably more outbound than engineering oriented, but some of both. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that Jay was responsible in any way for the problems that NetApp is having keeping up with everybody else. I think it's really unfair to pin that on Jay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an organization with a lot of people.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. What now? We've lost BP. They now are losing JKID. How much is there left? What's their challenge beyond just regular innovation and new products? Is there a challenge ahead in building a new CTO team?
Well, you know, with Kidd leaving and Pawlowski leaving, it's a very interesting thing. These two guys, you know, were both visible and, you know, involved somewhat with technology decisions, Pawlowski more so probably, and maybe feeling like their time was up. I think it's, you know, NetApp really is at this precipice. You know, are they going to pull it together, or are they just going to slowly become irrelevant? Right. Like, they have too big an install base to become irrelevant overnight, but, you know, they're probably close to it. I mean, JKID has millions of dollars probably that he can put his hands on. And what this amounts to is that he really would rather have a life that is, you know, he would like to be able to travel, go places and do things and not have to think about NetApp anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He made the exact same comments as David Scott made, as in, my kids are now that age, coming out of college, and I want to spend more time with my kids now.
Well, in fact, in Jay's kid is older than David's. David's is a middle schooler. I think Jay said his oldest is now going to school. So the nest is empty. David's got a bird in the nest. Jay's nest, I believe, is empty. He wants to go do other things. And, you know, when you want to go to Florence and you want to go to, you know, London, you want to go to Prague and all these places, you don't want to have to be calling in and checking in for email anymore. He wants to live a life outside of NetApp. That's what I got out of this. Yeah. It's like, it was a great ride. I really enjoyed it. I hope it does well. I still have a lot of stock. I still have a lot of friends. But you know what? I'm tired of it.
Yeah, I totally get that. And we all wish him a lot of luck, I guess. And maybe, you know what, maybe NetApp finds their own new Satya Nadella at technology.
Well, there might be. I mean, sometimes it's guys like this leaving that force the issue. It forces, you know, whether the board is cognizant of this, it's not clear to me. They might be, right? You know, who knows what's going on in that board and in senior management of that company. If they're not aware that they've got a crisis, you know, after this stuff's going on, they're going to suffer badly, right? But maybe this will wake them up. And they can try to figure out what to do. Hard to say. It might be too late. You know, go to the LinkedIn group, folks, and they might still be able to pull it out.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a good one to wrap up our show here. Any specifics of what are your plans for the next week, Mark?
Oh, I don't know. I'm, you know, be watching television, drinking beer, the usual.
Oh, Jesus. You're doing the exact same thing as I do, but you have a job. Gabe, you want to say
something? That is a full-time job, drinking beer and watching television. I mean, you may not get paid to do it, but, you know. Next week, I will be in Boulder, Colorado at Solidfire for the entire week. Get my learn on, and then you'll be able to find me at the OpenStack Summit up in Vancouver, where hopefully we'll be able to get a show going in person with a lot of great people that are going to be attending there. I'd be really keen to talk to anybody who is enterprise class looking to deploy OpenStack, and I'll be digging around and get some of those people. Other than that, and you can always find me on the Twitter.
Yep. Okay. That's it for this week, guys. And see you all and hear you all next week.